Good morning. I'm reading from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 18, verses 1 through 5. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a little child and had him stand among them, and he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me." Thanks be to God.
Today we are celebrating the lives of three women who were born in Western New York. Each woman was faced with a situation that required faith, strength, and courage to act on behalf of women and children. Did you know that women in India in 1869 could not receive medical care because male doctors could not treat women and all the doctors were men?
I am the youngest of 10 children and grew up in Cast Isle, New York, near Silver Lake. My name is Clara Swain. As a child, I was rather small and not very strong, but I was exuberant, fun-loving, and I'm afraid a little spoiled. My father was Irish, and I got my sense of humor from him. My mother was a quiet, reserved New Englander. I attended the Methodist Episcopal Church in Cast Isle, and I worried that God might be displeased with me because I wasn't more like my mother. But Mother assured me that it was my Christian duty to please God by being cheerful and joyous. As a young woman, I moved to Canandaigua to live with my aunt, and I began to teach in a public school. I discovered I was not a teacher. It was not for me. I probably shouldn't even admit this on Children's Sabbath, but I found the school children, well, rather irksome. I was sure that God had something else in mind for me, but what? One day, I received a letter from a close friend, a woman physician, who suggested that I become a doctor. I still wasn't physically strong, and could I endure the training? If I succeeded, could I face the antagonism women doctors had to bear? After several months of considering and praying, I was sure that this is what God wanted me to do. A door soon opened, and I had the opportunity to train with Dr. Cordelia Green back in my hometown at the Cast Isle Sanitarium. After 3 years of training, I felt strong enough to pursue my calling and was accepted at the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I loved my studies, but was uncertain where I would be able to practice. Women doctors were not accepted in most places. We were trained for service and encouraged to go where the need was greatest. Personal reward and distinction were not for us. During my time in Philadelphia, I did have the opportunity to hear many celebrated preachers offer inspiring and challenging sermons. As my graduation drew nearer and nearer, I asked myself, where is this place of great need that God wants me to fill? In the spring of 1869, I was suddenly confronted with a breathtaking and frightening invitation. I received a letter from a group of churchwomen who wanted to send me to India. India! The very word conjured up images of idols and snakes, of suffocating heat and dust and surging masses and blinding colors, incredible beauty, and unimaginable need. The letter said, and I quote, "Your name was suggested to us by one of your professors As one most competent, most conscientious, and most dedicated to Christian service." End quote. I had never considered anything like this. I had finally finished college at age 35, and they were asking me, Clara Swain, to be the first woman missionary doctor ever sent to a foreign land. Could I leave all that was familiar? Was I strong enough to endure the living that conditions that India would have? Was this what God wanted me to do? I graciously asked the women to give me 3 months to think and to pray. In the end, the answer was yes. Yes, I was ready. Yes, this was my calling, and I graciously accepted and set my sights on going to India. The Women's Foreign Missionary Society of the Methodist Episcopal Church had been voted into existence by 8 determined women at the Tremont Street Church in Boston on March 23rd in 1869. They were spurred to action by Mrs. Butler, who had lived in India 10 years earlier while her husband served as the first Methodist missionary to India. By the end of May 1869, more women had joined the fledgling organization and had voted to send Isabella Thoburn, a teacher, to India. But Mrs. Butler would not rest until they sent a woman doctor. She had been heartbroken when she saw desperately ill Indian women left on the banks of the Ganges River to die because no man was allowed to look on the face of a caste woman, and all the physicians were men. By the time I accepted their invitation in September, Miss Thoburn was booked to begin her travels to India in November 3rd. The women wanted to send us together, but had less than 2 months to raise $1,000. That would be $17,000 in your day and age. At a meeting on September 9th, 1869, it was Mrs. Porter who galvanized their resolve when she said in a firm, clear voice, and I'm quoting, "Sisters, shall we lose Miss Thoburn and Dr. Swain because we have not the means in sight to send them? No! Rather, let the Methodist women of Boston walk the streets in calico gowns and save the expense of more costly apparel. But let us send these missionaries to our sisters across the sea," end quote. Needless to say, Isabella and I set sail on November 3rd. In January of 1870, after more than 2 months of travel, I arrived in Bareilly, India, site of the Methodist missionary and orphanage. I wrote home, "India is far more beautiful than I expected, and far more ugly. The mission gardens were bursting with fresh vegetables, exotic fruits, fragrant flowers. The walls outside the mission were teeming with starvation, pestilence, and disease. Malaria, smallpox, cholera, they all came and went in their seasons. I spent my first days caring for the sick children in the orphanage, calling on the sick in the slums, and treating any sick person who came to the mission house. I cared for anyone who needed treatment, wealthy, poor, Christian, Hindu, Muslim. I began teaching medical classes for the older girls in the orphanage so they could help care for women and children. Near the end of my second year in India, a group of us from the mission approached the Nawab, the Muslim ruler of a princely state, who owned the land next to our mission. We asked to purchase some of his land on which to build a hospital for women and children. He refused to sell us the land. Praise God, he gave it to us. I knew it was God at work. The new hospital opened in January of 1874. For 25 years, I spent most of my time in India, healing, teaching, and sharing my hope in Christ with all who would listen. At age 62, I left my service in India. But I returned 10 years later in 1906 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Methodist mission and spent 18 months among the people who had become so dear to me. Clara Swain died in Castile on December 25, 1910. The hospital that bears her name was operated by the Methodist Church in India until 2011. It has been revamped into a modern super specialty hospital under the guidance of Mr. Umesh Gautman, the Chancellor of Invertis University in Bareilly. In the spirit of its founder, the Clara Swain Mission Hospital today strives, quote, to provide world-class health care to all sections of the society that is affordable to all. The Methodist Church in India continues to run the Rural Health and Community Development Project of Clara Swain Hospital in Faridpur, serving the poor in the rural villages. The Women's Foreign Missionary Society was a predecessor of what we today know as the United Methodist Women.
It wasn't the accepted thing to do, but Clara Swain made some noise.
Yep.
It's time for the people of Christ Church to make some noise too. Did you know that in 1873, there were no laws protecting children from abuse, but there were laws protecting animals?
Hi, my name is Mary Ellen Wilson. I was born in 1864 to Francis and Thomas Wilson in New York City. My father died shortly after I was born, so my mother had to go to work. Since she was unable to stay at home and take care of me, I was boarded and eventually given up to the city's Department of Charities. The Department of Charities illegally placed me with Mary and Thomas McCormick, who claimed to be my biological father. Thomas died shortly after taking me in. Mary then married Francis Connolly, and we moved to a tenement on West 41st Street. I was so young when all of this occurred that I do not remember a time when I did not live with the Connollys. Mama whipped me with a leather whip and beat me almost every day. I had black and blue marks on my head and a cut on the left side of my forehead where Mama struck me with a pair of scissors and cut me. I have no recollection of ever being kissed by anyone, never kissed by Mama. I never dared to speak to anybody because if I did, I would get whipped. I do not know what I was whipped for. Mama never said anything to me when she whipped me. I have no recollection of ever being outside in my life. One day, a woman named Etta Engel Wheeler knocked on my door. She was a caring Methodist mission worker who regularly visited the poor residents of the tenements. While Miss Wheeler was visiting a neighbor, the neighbor told her that she often heard cries of a child in distress across the hall. Miss Wheeler introduced herself to Mama and was unable to see me. I was dirty, thin, dressed in threadbare clothes, and had bruises and scars along my bare legs and arms. I was 9 years old at the time, but I was the size of a five-year-old. Ms. Wheeler left without speaking to me, and I did not see her again until my rescue 3 months later. It turns out that she attempted to have the New York City authorities remove me from the Connolly's home, but the authorities were reluctant to intervene. Finally, in desperation, she turned to Henry Burge, who was a leader of the animal humane movement in the United States and founder of the ASPCA. Ms. Wheeler found several of our neighbors that were willing to testify about my abuse, and she brought written documents about it to Mr. Burr. Mr. Burr sent a New York ASPCA investigator to verify my abuse. An ASPCA attorney prepared a petition to have me removed from the home of the Connollys. After several hearings and several newspaper accounts describing my abuse, I was removed from the Connollys' home. Mama was arrested and put in jail. I ended up living with Ms. Wheeler's mother in northern New York until her death, and then lived the rest of my childhood with Ms. Wheeler's sister, Elizabeth, and her husband, Darius. They were wonderful parents. In my late 20s, I had a daughter that I named Etta, in honor of the woman that saved my life and the woman that began a movement for a formalized child protection system.
It wasn't the safe thing to do, but Etta Wheeler made some noise. Did you know that Buffalo had the first daycare center in the United States for children of working women?
Welcome. Welcome to all of you who have come today to recognize and celebrate how precious our children are to us. My name is Mariah Love. I'm so pleased to see all of you here today. Things look so different than what they did in my time. How changed the world has become. But progress is what brings us together. We learn from the past and we see into the future. My purpose in being here today is to share with you the story of my life and how I became interested in making the lives of little children better. I was born on a farm in Clarence, New York, on January 26, 1840. At a young age, I could saddle and ride my horse anywhere. One day, Father asked me and my sister to fetch a horse from the pasture. He said five of his workers had tried to catch the horse and couldn't. My sister and I went down to the pasture, called to Bill, that was the name of the horse, and he came trotting up to us as he always did. Bill walked beside us as we took him up to the barn. I have always loved horses. I kept my horse, carriage, and sleigh until 1929. Something that was faster and more comfortable came along and replaced them. I always worried about the horses getting sick or hurting themselves in the cold winters of Western New York. Now I'm safe and warm, too, in my newfangled motor car. Father died when I was 13. My sister and I went to live in a grand home on Delaware Avenue. I participated in productions of an amateur group of thespians. I sang in the choir at Central Presbyterian Church, and I crossed the Atlantic 14 times. So many modern developments have come along during my life. I'm afraid of airplanes and all the new statuses of women. Imagine women smoking. Their pursuit of careers and the feeling of restlessness. When I was young, it was disgusting for women to smoke, and men wouldn't smoke in front of a lady. I think the idea that women are working outside of the home is going to bring about the destruction of family life, and this in turn is going to be bad for the community. I'm in favor of prohibition. Nothing good comes from too much of the drink. Women are also working toward the idea of obtaining the right to vote. My word, I am interested in all questions of human welfare, but do not recognize the necessity for women to be involved in issues of government. I strongly believe that this will also bring about the deterioration of the family, the home, and children. If women vote, it will only bring about more burdens to be laid upon her. While visiting in France, I became aware of the plight of children of working mothers. I returned to Buffalo in 1881 and established the Fitch Creche. I secured a building which had been used as a dry goods store at 159 Swan Street, owned by Benjamin Fitch. Mr. Fitch generously donated his store to our worthy cause. Our daycare center officially opened January 6, 1881. The Fitch Creche was nationally recognized as the first daycare center for the children of working women in the United States. By 1885, just 4 years later, we had taken care of over 20,000 babies. At the creche, we believe that it is important for children to realize that the prevention of pauperism lies within the children. We mean to instill in them the ideas of order, cleanliness, and thrift. To save them from the neglect of squalid homes, keep them out of the streets and gutters, and most of all, to remove from their lives beggary and the disgrace of municipal relief. We want to build a future generation that is self-reliant, Clean and Thrifty, the Road to Independent Citizenship. We do charge a daily fee for each child, 5 cents, which may be returned if the circumstances warrant it. In 1885, we collected $296.60. There's a price placed on each cradle and crib of $15. Many organizations and groups have volunteered to furnish these items through their charity. When the children arrive at the creche, they are taken for a bath. A uniform is provided, and they go to a playroom until breakfast is at 8 o'clock. Playtime follows breakfast, dinner at 11. The children participate in serious activities of learning during the day. An afternoon romp in the open air and a nap are also part of the daily activity. After washing face and hands at 4 o'clock, supper is eaten. The little ones change back into his or her clothes to wait for a family member to come and take them home. We support that cleanliness, good wholesome food, association with many children, and the care of nurses has created good manners, orderly natures, and self-reliance. Such is a day at the Fitch Creche. We have felt that all of the goodness that comes as a result of our daycare demonstrates the usefulness of such an organization. We have been frequently called the best charity in Buffalo. I'm thankful to you for allowing me to tell you a bit about myself and this wonderful task of caring for children so they can have a better life. Mariah lived until the age of 91. She directed the Fitch Creche for over 50 years. Today, Mariah Love's vision for the care and education of children continues. The Mariah Love Convalescent Fund Board continues its service to the community and is responsible for raising funds necessary to carry on its mission. Currently, the fund provides short-term emergency financial assistance for Erie County residents with qualifying medical conditions. The fund also supports transportation, medications, food, and utility support to qualifying residents. The money for the many agencies is raised through the annual charity ball.
It wasn't the easy thing to do, but Mariah Love made some noise. Each woman chose to make some noise when she encountered poverty and injustice, making a difference in the lives of women and children. Each woman left a lasting legacy that is still making a difference in the lives of people today.
Amazing that we have such amazing women in our history. I'd like to read a poem written by Anne Weems. I watched her go uncelebrated into the second grade, a greenless child, gray among the orange and yellow, attached too much to the corners and to other people's sunshine. She colors the rainbow brown and leaves balloons unopened in their packages. Oh, who will touch this greenless child? Who will plant alleluias in her heart and send her dancing into all the colors of God? Or will she be left like an unwrapped package on the kitchen table, too dull for anyone to take the trouble? Does God think we're her keeper? If we're listening today, we may have heard God's call to make a difference for someone else in this world. If we were listening today, we've heard about some brave women of the past who noticed others struggling and found ways to help relieve their struggle and improve their lives. If we were listening today, we may even feel sadness or compassion or even a little anger at the suffering people's lives have that goes unnoticed every day. If we were listening, we may be hearing the sound of someone who is suffering. We may be listening and wrestling with our own thoughts or ideas of ways that we could make a difference for others. If we're listening, it's time to respond as we offer ourselves and our gifts to make a difference. Love cannot be silenced. It's time to make some noise.